Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block, Season 6 of the two-time Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you today like one Glenn Allen Anzalone, not Avalone, but Anzalone, better known as Glenn Danzig. Tell your children not to walk my way, Avalone. Tell your children not to hear my words, what they mean, what they say. Because the bottom line is, I'm not about to see your light. But if you want to find hell with me, I can show you what it's like till you're bleeding. Yeah, there you go. That was a long one, but that was a fun one. Glenn Danzig used to live down the street from me in Los Feliz. He lived in this house that looked like it was from a horror movie. Or from Universal Halloween Horrors Nights, and sure. It used to be like a pilgrimage for metalheads. They would drive all the way out. They would get out in front and they would take selfies in front of the house. And he famously had a massive pile of bricks in his yard. I think the idea was that he was going to build something, never built it. And the neighbors were livid about the bricks, and they would stand up at city council meetings and complain about Glenn Danzig's bricks. So that's my Glenn Danzig.
I'm impressed that he was willing to have his address be out there for people to know. But I guess metalheads are a gentle bunch.
I think in the days of the internet, stuff gets out there. But here was the thing, is that the address is out there. You never know if it was the actual address. But for a while, it used to be that you could, in Google Maps, you could enter the address. And the Google Maps picture was the insane house, but Glenn Danzig was out in the driveway and he was washing his Jaguar. And it was this outline of a person who could only be Glenn Danzig. It was amazing.
I love that. My landlord's parents live in the apartment next to me. One of them, the grandpa, has passed away. But there was a minute where Google Maps showed Grandpa napping on the porch. And I always liked looking. Google Street View was like, there's Grandpa. He will, if you drive by the house, he absolutely will be asleep in that chair. That is accurate. That is some accurate information.
He'll be out there.
But yeah.
That's wonderful.
It's crazy stuff. I also used to be able to visit a car of mine that got, that I had to get rid of. That Google Maps still showed parked in front of my apartment building for about a year after I got rid of it.
I remember we had a friend that lived in a really nice apartment in Silver Lake, but the Google Maps was this really shitty. There was this really shitty van parked in front of the house. and so the thing drives by and it just gets a picture of a van. So if you dial her nice address, in Silver Lake into it, you just see a really shitty van and it looked like she lived in the van. Wonderful.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. So let's talk about what you got going on. You got your Evel Knievel Kickstarter happening, even as we speak.
I think as this rolls, we have about a week left in the Evel Knievel Kickstarter campaign. It is the first and only Evel Knievel comic book series. We're working with the Evel Knievel family and the Evel Knievel brand and the Evel Knievel Museum. And we are doing this wonderful ass-kicking book with artist Dave Acosta, who you know a little bit about.
My old buddy Dave, yep.
Yeah, we have covers by Ray Anthony Height, who's one of our best buds here on the show. Flops did an amazing cover. Ringo Award nominee Fabio Elvez. This amazing cartoonist named John Pinto. It's a hell of a book. We're kicking ass and taking names over on Kickstarter. Not just the books, but we're selling really amazing Evel Knievel swag. You know, we got the license and that allowed us to make pins and old event posters and skateboards. And there's just a lot of amazing stuff over there. So go check it out, particularly if you're a fan. We had a ton of fun doing the book and Dave's kicking ass on it. So go get it.
Nice.
What do you got going on?
Very nice. I'm part of a current Kickstarter for an anthology of short stories called Curiouser and Curiouser 2. I wrote a story called The Looking Glass Girl, which is a little something about childhood and first love and a little David Lynchian, what's under the surface of your nice suburban street memoir type stuff. But it's a good, sort of haunting romantic stories collection with a lot of great writers and colleagues and friends in it. So that's fun.
The interesting thing is that it actually takes place at Glenn Danzig's house in Los Feliz. So synergy.
Yeah, but there are no bricks. Yeah, that's what I got going on right now. I'm writing Red Sonja 2. I got a bunch of cool, interesting shit coming from Dynamite that hasn't been announced yet that I can't talk about. And then next year will be my series, Two Fisted Fairy Tales, which Dave will also be drawing when he finishes Evel Knievel.
Yeah, there you go. Busy guy.
But let us bring in our guest, ladies and gentlemen in Ships at Sea, Mr. Zach Quaintance.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Zach, thanks for joining us. And thanks for being part of the Bookshelf Background Club, because you know this nice. Is a very important thing.
I work really hard on this background, so it's very, very well cultivated to appear curated? In this sort of thing. So.
Nice. Yeah, I think yours is better designed than ours is. We just kind of have
Mine is definitely haphazard. I did make
I just moved
a couple of comic covers, but that's about it.
Yeah, I just moved recently, so I had a chance to sort of overhaul and start from scratch with this, and it's not cobbled together over years, which I assume is probably a situation for you.
Oh yeah, I've been in this space 28 years. You're in New York City. What part of town?
I'm in Brooklyn, just south of Prospect Park. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Lovely area. I love Prospect Park.
And, beautiful park. Nicer than Central Park, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, I think that's actually true. I think that's definitely true. Nice museum. The botanical gardens are in there, right?
Yeah, and the Brooklyn Museum. Yeah.
Yeah, those are great places to go. Tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself, Zach.
Yeah, I'm a comic book writer as well as a comic book journalist. I run the review section for Heidi McDonald's website, Comics Beat.
Very Eisner nice. Winning as of a few months back.
Eisner winning.
That's right. Yeah, as of July, the Eisner winning website, Comics Beat.
So how cool long has Comics Beat as a website been around? I know Heidi's been doing it for a long time, but I don't know that she was branded as Comics Beat that whole time.
It celebrated its 20th anniversary last year. So 21 years as of this year, old enough to drink now. And it did just start as her doing sort of, I think, a newsletter, like
through
a listserv way back when in those days. But I've been contributing for about 7 years now, full-blown site in the whole time I've been doing it.
I think the first time you and I interacted, you had Comics Bookcase.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you had your Drawing Blood book.
You interviewed me about Drawing Blood. Felt like there was something else as well, but we definitely talked about that.
I feel like I go all the way back to Batman's Bookcase.
Yeah, I think you do.
Are we allowed to say that anymore? Is that a
Yeah, we can say it. I mean, I don't think DC's lawyers will bring the hammer down on my now defunct website.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we wrote about your comics on Batman's Bookcase.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
what are you working on right now? We brought you on to talk about what the current story is.
Yeah, I've got a Kickstarter of my own. It's called Macabre Valley. It's a grindhouse Texas horror comic. Very loosely based on my time as a night cops reporter in South Texas. Quick pitch for it is a young reporter gets his first job in South Texas after a Border Patrol agent is murdered, quickly becomes involved in a mystery with a beloved local priest and a werewolf at its dark center. So that's what I'm
very nice.
What I'm promoting across the comics internet for the past few weeks or so.
Very nice. And how's it doing so far?
It's done really well. We fund it like in the first week. It's always nice. Get some better sleep after that. Sure. And like now I'm just, I had a weird thing. The first Kickstarter I did like 4 years ago set a backer record for me that I've never been able to break. And I'm obsessed with breaking it.
Hope it's, now is a really
how close
bad
are
time
you now?
To try and,
How close am I? Let me do them at 16 plus 28. So 44.
But, that's not bad. And you got a couple of weeks left, or you got a week left when this will air.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Ryland? Ryland, you were saying something a little bit about the current the state
of current climate of Kickstarter. It is a very bad time to point, you know, to point your finger to right field and say I'm going to break that record. It's you know, backer numbers are down and you know, amounts are down, and it's just you know, people are scared with the economy and all that stuff. But
I would say like Kickstarter in 2020 was like Kickstarter on easy mode. Like, you know, everybody was home. The comics internet was centralized on Twitter. Some people had extra money with the pandemic relief fund and all that. So yeah, those were the days. And I mean, now there's just so many cool projects on Kickstarter as well, too, that there's a lot more people using it and taking it seriously. So yeah, it is like one of those sports records that's like comparing two different eras or something.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, the ball was definitely juiced in 2020. For your home run hitters, we all were on steroids in 2020.
I mean, combination of that, but it is a very bad time right now. You know, again, because of the economy, because of all these things. But you're right in that the market is also very saturated, and for better and for worse. And you know, you have bigger companies that big companies are having a really hard time making money in the comic shops right now, and they can go on to Kickstarter and have these $100,000 campaigns, and that obviously, like, you know, that helps the bottom line there. So you have more of those people coming on, but even those things are, you know, this Toxic Avenger campaign, you know, I think, you know, they had Legendary behind it for a lot of money, a lot of oomph, and I think they were counting on that being a $100,000 campaign, and it ended up being, you know, a $50,000 campaign. They probably lost money on it. So even those bigger companies are hurting right now. I mean, I think how you and I end up negatively affected more than anything is that when things were booming, and then we watched the Pat Shands kind of like double down, triple down, and start putting on a lot of books. And everybody said, oh, I can do that. And so I think what has hurt us more than anything is that this community of creators, these people that we like, even, you know, when I saw like a lower mid tier creator being like, here are the 12 Kickstarter campaigns I'm running this year, I knew it was the end of the salad days, you know?
Yeah.
Only somebody
that you, as is so often the case, though, you will see a shakeout of that, you know, when you know, not to pick on whoever that person was, but like when 8 of those 12 don't fund, or fund, but they've been given funding numbers that don't actually support finishing the project, which is a pretty common thing right now. People will drop away and we'll be left with it. I mean, also the other thing in 2020 is very simply like the other end of the business that Kickstarter competes with disintegrated. We did 3 Elvira Kickstarters that year because I was told pencils down on the comic shop Elvira comic I was writing, and they were like, well, the audience is there and they want to buy these comics. We have to mail them to them now, or email them to them rather than them counting on them going to their comic book store.
That was 3 campaigns to the tune of $350,000 also. So yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. It was, yeah. I mean, the third one had already dropped off a bit. Cause I think we oversaturated a tiny bit, but the books were popular and did crazy well. And, you know, and now I don't think they would do that number. They would do a good number, but they wouldn't do what they did at that exact moment when there was no entertainment beyond streaming video and Kickstarter.
Podcast.
That was it. That was
especially if you're
it.
Looking for new stuff. Like there was one of the only kind of avenues to get something new that hadn't been banked or whatever. I think there's a little bit of a silver lining too, to like the oversaturation and the like publishers on the platform. Like the upshot to that is, I think if there was any stigma to like books that are originally funded through Kickstarter, it's totally gone now. Like, so it is harder to fund, but once you do, I think, you know, it's a friendlier climate towards crowdfunded comics.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and as someone with a crowdfunded book that is now coming out from Image, I'm like, I don't actually know how you do the Image deal without a crowdfunded book, unless you are absurdly independently wealthy and can just fund your comics out of your pocket, or if everyone is willing to do it on spec, which is, I'm too old for that. I'm too old to do it.
No,
I'm too old to ask friends to do it. So,
and that's you—that's you saying that with Kevin Eastman as a partner. You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
if you don't have, you know, and you are a recognizable enough name in your, you know, in your own right, but man, if you guys can't make it go, then who can?
It's hard,
and I mean, I think the key right now, if you are going to do your Image book, is probably four issue arcs and then move on, because then because then you are not as negatively affected by attrition, you know, if you're trying to do a 10 or 12 issue arc.
No, I definitely,
we're
on issue 9 coming out next, and I absolutely wish we had done 3-4 issue. We're going 1-12.
Yeah.
And I know that if issue 9 was Volume 3, Issue 1, it would have 20 times the sales that it has right now.
I think we're onto it with like oversaturation of Kickstarter. I think there was also like an oversaturation just of, if you guys had done 4 issues, like waited a year and then put out 4 more issues, and it was an event every time, and it's like, oh shit, that's back, and let me go read the other ones, and that maybe that was a thing. And I mean, it is something that I'm dealing with now with, you know, I mean, we have the Evel Knievel license, right? And the idea is to do, to start with a 4-issue arc and then do a trade. And the idea of how to schedule that, to where people aren't getting tired of Evel Knievel on Kickstarter, where people aren't, you know, where people aren't like, ah, I'm going to sit issue 3 out and I'll catch up later or something like that. Cause you get a lot of that, right? You're too much, and people are like, oh, well, it'll be back in 3 months anyway.
On issue 9, I don't even think people are waiting for the trade. I think they're waiting for the omnibus. They're not waiting for the third trade. They're like, they'll put all 3 of these in a book.
Hardcover.
Yeah. All 12 of these will be in a beautiful hardcover that I can get Kevin to do a remark in the next time I see him at a convention. I'll buy that. Not to whine. I've loved working with Image, and they're great folks, and the market is what the market is. And, you know, the more I look back on the transition from buying my comics in 7-Elevens to buying them in comic book stores, the more I realized that wasn't necessarily a great deal for all of us. You know, like, it was great in the 80s. It was great in the early 80s when comic readership was still high. But as comic readership has declined, only being able to get them in specialty shops is not the greatest thing. I would love to see spinner racks come back to, I would love to walk into a CVS and see a spinner rack with comic books on it. Because I still I think, you know, the 6-year-old who's in there with their mom would go, oh, get me one. You know what I mean? Like, I think it would work. And it's a pity that that's not there, but that's, you know, old man yells at cloud, podcast.
something has to change. I mean, it's getting harder and harder to find the books. I mean, we've lost a lot of great comic shops, you know, over these last couple of years. My favorite shop, down the street, the, Comics Factory, which was like, it was the one place where you could get like everything around here, you know? And that's gone. We got a lot of them just kind of dropping off, but even like the ones that are still around, they have like really limited hours. I walked into a comic shop. I was out in the valley like a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking for something specific. And I walked in, and the comic shop, I don't remember the title of the name of the comic shop, but it literally had comics in the title. It was like Joe's Comics and Games or whatever. Walked in, games everywhere, ain't no comics. They had probably like 10 DC or Marvel books that had come out that week, and that was the beginning and the end of it. And I couldn't believe it. It's like, this used to be a thriving comic book shop. And now it is, you know, now there's like an end cap basically, you know? And that's the reality we're facing right now. And that is troubling.
I mean, they're trying some things like these, compact editions, like the DC's doing and Image is increasingly doing. Like,
every shop owner I talk to says those sell like crazy. Like kids recognize them as like sort of smaller books that they can hold and read. And they remind mm-hmm. them of manga, which helps with kids these days. And I've even seen them like, I'm from Chicago. And last time I was flying back home, the bookstore at O'Hare Airport had a cardboard stand full of those DC compact books. Like, so they're trying new things to like yeah. to get like new formats and rolling the dice on them. But I mean, time will tell, I guess. But it does seem like the single issue in particular is in a little bit of trouble.
I mean, the problem is like DC is owned by a conglomerate. And so even the people who are working at DC to try to figure this stuff out, they're fighting off their backs because the corporate overlords make it very difficult for them. You know what I'm saying? It's, you know, when a company is run by a conglomerate, there's this old story about Bill Gates where it's like they parted it out and it's Bill Gates makes a certain amount of money every, you know, every minute or whatever. And the idea was that if he was walking to his car, saw a $100 bill on the ground, it would actually cost him money to stop and pick up the $100 bill. And so like, when you start talking to like the head of the like Warner Brothers, you know, conglomerate, about a $3 floppy, they tune the fuck out, you know? And what they don't understand is that you're talking about seeds, you know, it's like these things grow and they, you know, and they're the key to the entire operation, but they don't have the vision to see that necessarily. Harder times because Warner Brothers is up for sale and it's going to get absorbed by another one of these big conglomerates very soon. And hopefully, you know, I don't know, forward-thinking CEO or something like that, but like, but it's bad news, you know. It probably means less comics. It probably means less importance put on the comics. It probably means, you know, yeah, look at fucking Showtime. You know, Showtime used to be this big deal thing, right? And then it gets kind of absorbed into the, you know, the Time Warner sphere, and it ends up as like a tile on HBO Max or whatever. And
isn't Showtime in the CBS Paramount?
Is it not? Maybe I'm talking about.
Yeah,
Showtime's basically gone also, but just on a different stream.
No, yeah. That's what I mean. You're not
these things. Yeah, I don't even know where these things are anymore.
That's how bad it is.
It used to be a thing, and it used to be a tastemaker. It used to be the biggest thing, the best thing, and now what is it? You know.
I forgot about it. I had forgotten entirely about Showtime.
Yeah, there are still like better. I think on Paramount Plus, there is a Showtime tile that has like one or two original programs on it or something.
Who did the Twin Peaks, The Return? Was that?
That was Showtime.
That was Showtime, right? That's the last time I remember thinking about them. Yeah. And I don't know what happened to them from there.
Yeah. And it, basically it's a production office now is what it is. That's all it is. It's like, it's a little room, you know, in some weird corner of a studio, and there's a guy or a gal who's the head of Showtime, and that used to be one of the biggest jobs in town and one of the best jobs in town, and now it's a caddy's position, you know.
Well, yeah, like these kind of things, when you start thinking about them and talking, kind of really get you down, but the antidote is supporting independent art, right? Like that'll make you feel a little bit better, I guess, about where things are headed.
Well, and
you can do that still.
You know, someone said in reply to something that I was talking about in the comics industry the other day that it's never been worse to be an independent artist. And I kind of let it go, but I think the opposite is actually true. I mean, when I was a struggling filmmaker in the 90s, I would have killed for YouTube to exist.
If I
would have, you know, and it's even when people talk about like publishers or famous people, Keanu Reeves using crowdfunding sites. I always remind them, like, Martin Scorsese gets turned down for things that he pitches to studios. Like, if Kickstarter had existed in 1980, we would have gotten The Last Temptation of Christ starring Robert De Niro. Because he would have been able to go, oh, fuck it, I'll go off and get, I'll raise $10 million on my own and make this movie by myself. I always say there would have been 10 more Orson Welles movies if Kickstarter
had existed. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
If Kickstarter had existed since the 1960s, you know, Macbeth would actually have some, Orson Welles' Macbeth would have some internal continuity, because he would have been able to shoot it in a month rather than a weekend every couple of years for 5 years.
What can you imagine doing? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Can you imagine him doing his like Kickstarter video? Or he's like, "Hey guys, it's me, Orson. Like, you might know me from Citizen Kane." Like,
it would have been fucking like. I'm sorry we never got to live in a world where Orson Welles was shitposting on Twitter. Like, I think that would have been the funniest fucking thing. I did a commercial this morning for peas. They were the biggest idiots I've ever encountered in my life.
Well. I mean, that would have been the cost, is that he wouldn't have had to do fish stick commercials, and we would have you know, been deprived of that, of the wonder of that. So I think maybe
or the Transformers movie, maybe, you know.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, for all of the challenges we're up against, it is the golden age of, you know, I've seen artists develop on Instagram where they were someone I stumbled across who had something beautiful were funny, and they had 20 followers, and I followed them because I stumbled across something beautiful or funny. And then I go to Artist Alley 5 years later, I can't hang out with them anymore in chat because they've got a line out the door just because they drew a funny thing on Instagram and it made them a superstar in a very specific way, but in a way that would have in 1975, they would have taken the cartoons to King Featured Syndicate. King Featured Syndicate would have said, "No, you suck, fuck off," and that would have been, and they would have been a high school art teacher, and that would have been it, and that would have gone away forever. All of that beautiful stuff—that's the thing you always mourn for—is the people who never got a chance, who didn't. You know, who didn't have a way to put their art out there. You know, I always get irrationally mad when people tell newcomers, just do the work, it'll get found. I'm like,
right, yeah.
Motherfucker, that is not true. I wish I lived in that beautiful world that you live in. But no, brilliant shit gets made all the time that nobody sees, nobody cares about, that doesn't find an agent, that doesn't find a producer, that doesn't find a publisher. And it's heartbreaking. You know,
one of the
best writer that I went to high school with, one of the funniest men I've ever met in my life, has been writing he's had a career as a writer for a medical textbook company for 40 years. And I'm glad he's got the work. I'm glad that he found something that he could live with and enjoy. But like, there's a part of me that goes, If I had a TV show, I would have flown this guy out here to be in the writer's room. You know what I mean? Like, and that would be a whole other life. And look, maybe he wouldn't want that. That's the other thing you never know about other human beings. But this idea that great work always gets found, or that, you know, talent is its own reward, man, I wish. You know, and failing that, we got to go out on social media and bang the drum, and we got to go on Kickstarter, and we got to make art with our friends and put it in front of people and hope that anyone notices. And it is a golden age for that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. For someone who would have been busking in the subway can now make videos of themselves busking in the subway that a million people watch.
Yeah.
You know?
And we say it a lot here, where it's like, it used to be there were five companies and they were all run by like 50-year-old white guys, and you had to go and get the permission of one of those 50-year-old white guys to make your comic book. And and a lot of things, particularly if you were, you know, from a different place or, you know, whatever, different cultural background, you know, you loved somebody different, whatever. All those people got told no. And because of that, for decades, 80% of the population walked into a comic shop and didn't see themselves on the shelves. Right?
Yeah.
And that was a tragedy. And so when we see comic shops going away and whatnot, that is tragic in its own way. What is great is that no matter who you are, no matter who you love, no matter where you came from, no matter what you see when you look in the mirror, you can go on Kickstarter and you will see 5, 6, 10, 20 things that you see yourself in. That is wonderful. And if you are one of those creators, no matter who you are, you don't need permission to make your story. You make your story. If it is good, people will read it. They will love it. They will embrace it. You will find an audience. It's possible to do that now. And that is a fucking revelation, you know?
Yeah. And there's another layer to it, which, like, look, like, there's a lot of bad feelings in the world right now, right? But with Kickstarter, or like, just being able to support an artist directly, that's a good feeling. Like, that's it. Like, you get, yeah. It might cost a little bit more than something mass produced and kind of bought at a bigger store, but it's a nice thing to have your money go directly to someone who makes something you like and make it possible for them to continue making things. Like, that's a good feeling that we need kind of more of, like, every day, you know?
Yeah. Look, I don't know how many years ago it was, 5-6 years ago, I got to contribute to a Hal Hartley Kickstarter for a Hal Hartley movie. I know Ryland worked for Hal back in the day. And it's one of those things that Hal's one of my favorite indie filmmakers. And I'm so glad that he's not, I know it's more work for him and I know it's a pain in the ass, but a guy like Hal Hartley, it's never going to be 20th Century Fox presents Hal Hartley. That's not going to happen. So the fact that he's able to be out there making movies, you know, even into the present day because of social media and crowdsourcing, that's a beautiful thing. You know, no one necessarily has to go quietly into the night when their studio deal falls apart. I mean, when the thing was going on with Kimmel, as much as I wanted Disney to reinstate him and to have that nonsense be over because it was government pressure, I feel like Kimmel could have gone to YouTube TV, gotten a better deal, and had more viewers than he has on ABC television. In a weekend, he could have made that deal. Colbert, same thing. When Colbert's thing is up, he could just go on Patreon and be a billionaire.
It's what people don't understand right now. It's particularly what these conglomerates, what these companies don't understand, is that Kimmel does not need ABC. Like, he no longer needs the platform. Kimmel came back because coming back was a statement, because when he came back, he was going to have a lot of eyes and he was going to have unfettered access to say what he needed to say to these people. And he did a very good job on that, but also because he has a staff of 250 people that were counting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That had been compromised because of a writer strike, because of COVID, because of all these things, and he needed to take care of them. But he already had a foot out the door. He was already on a timer. He was already going to do about 2 more years and he wasn't going to sign the next contract.
And he already does have the YouTube contract for the YouTube version of his show.
Yeah.
And this is mostly just clips, but
yeah. And he is the platform, you know what I'm saying? We've seen this all over media where it was like ESPN. We watched ESPN destroy itself very quickly over about 10 years, where it used to be, if you wanted to hear great sports content, if you wanted to get the analysis that you wanted and needed, if you wanted these A+ analysts, you had to go to ESPN. That was what they had. But then they were like, no, ESPN highlights. This is all more important. We don't want to pay the people. We don't want to prop them up. We don't want to. And so they alienated talent after talent after talent.
Yeah, they did.
You look at a guy like Bill Simmons, who had, you know, created 30 for 30, created Grantland, was just doing incredible, like, innovative work, was a tastemaker, all of these things. They piss him off. They basically unceremoniously kick him out the door. He immediately founds The Ringer. Bill Simmons was like one of the first podcasters. Like, he called.
He really was. Yeah.
Yeah. And they would not embrace podcasting. And then, so what does he do? He goes, he founds The Ringer. Like, about 6 months later, he's selling it to Spotify for $250 million. Yeah. Now he is, like, you know, one of the five biggest media personalities in the world. ESPN had him, but not just him. ESPN had a ton of other people like him. And they did not see, but as Bill has proved, these guys are now the platforms. Right. And so, and we're kind of seeing it in comics, right? Where it's like, where we used to think that we needed publisher X. I'm not going to call it.
Oh, yeah. Name,
in order to do it. But no, it was like the moment Charlie Stickney tried for a very long time to get me on a Kickstarter. I didn't do it until COVID. And he was like, hey, you should do it now. And when I went over, I realized immediately that it's like, well, this is a much better deal than any publisher could ever give me. I keep my rights.
Keep your rights. Quality. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
so you have total control over the way you want to do your book. It gets to the point where it's like, because I was doing a lot of interviews for this, and people are like, oh, do you want to take your book to a publisher? And I'd like, why? Like, why would it, why, you know, why? I don't want to get lost on that being the end goal. Like, they need to make a persuasive argument over what they can even offer you at this point.
Well, here's the thing, is it can be a step along the way, because right now, you know, again, we have the Evel Knievel license, and this is not the last license we're going to have. We're negotiating for other ones and, you know, very close to signing a deal on the second one, which is a bigger one. But so we crowdfund and we make a big deal out of it. And the crowdfunding experience is its own very special experience. There should be a comic shop phase of the release process at some point. And that might mean that I have my own label, or I partner with people like Charlie and you and whomever, and we together take books into a comic shop and have our own thing with our own rules and all that stuff. It might be that I go to one of these publishers and I basically cut a licensing deal. Like, here, you pay me this much. You take the comic shops almost like it's territory, because cutting similar deals to go into bookstores like Amazon and Barnes and Noble, cutting similar deals overseas, where a bunch of publishers overseas, you find a French publisher and they're like, we will give you $15,000 for the rights to translate this into French and put it in French comic shops. They slap a new cover on it. You get to read your book in French. And then you do the same thing in Germany. You do the same thing in Spain. And so there is a process to it. And what the comic book companies have done to a degree for a savvy creator is they have made themselves just kind of like a bus stop along the way. You know?
And that's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's so funny how like the slapping a new cover on it is always the prerequisite. It's like oh, to get into a whole new country and open up your book to millions of new readers potentially. One new cover, that's what you need to do for us.
the new art is. You work for, you're a comics journalist, and like, and there are a lot of times where it's like, well, you know, again, like I think I have a pretty good story, you know, worked in the film business for a very long time. I'm bringing Evel Knievel to the table. Like, those are a lot of elements. But then the journalistic outfit will come back and be like, yes, but can we have an exclusive cover? Can we have a page that no one's ever seen? Can we?
There's like
a currency in the art, right? Where it's like, and it's kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. And you know, when you do one of these things, you like partition off the art. I mean, to pull back the curtain, to get coverage for this stuff, you partition off the art you have into like buckets of exclusives that you can take around and be like, do you want to do the exclusive for page 9, the colors? Like, you know, it is kind of funny, like that matters more than the actual content of what you're talking about to a lot of outlets.
Yeah. And that is so funny and interesting to me, because it feels like, you know, because again, I have Evel Knievel, right? And so it's like, well, let's, you know, how about, here's our pitch for an exclusive. How about Kelly Knievel and I sit down with somebody and we talk about, you know, we talk about the five craziest things Evel Knievel did on a motorcycle. We'll talk about them. Well, you know, so it actually has this like meaty content, and it has the,
it's a good read. Yeah.
Of it being a list and all of that stuff, but it's like people don't want that. They're like, no, we want to run a press release, and we want to run page 6, and we want to be the first person to run page 6. 10 people can run page 6 after we run page 6, but we want page 6. And it's a weird, and I mean, a lot of it is like there is so much to cover, and only so many people to cover it, and all of that stuff. And so I'm the thing I'm pitching is a lot more work intensive. It takes up a lot more bandwidth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. And some of these sites, it depends on the site. Like, some of them are basically the editor in chief and the owner, and then whoever will volunteer to work with them. So, like, if what they want
And they're doing maybe 5 posts in a day on top of a day job, potentially, like to make their like horror website keep functioning. So what they want is a well put together press release and that exclusive art that they can put on social media for the first time, to be the first one to put it out there and get it shared around. And like, it sucks that it has to work that way. But yeah, when sites don't have resources, it does kind of go from like, will this be interesting content, to like, what's the most easily packaged and convenient thing that'll get me clicks, like kind of makes that move.
Well, and so many sites are just aggregators where they're literally just running press releases day and night, you know,
copy and paste.
Every bit of content on the site is a press release and not rewritten, not with a new introductory sentence, nothing. Just here's the press release with my byline on it for some reason.
Well, it's really funny from an Evel Knievel perspective, because like a lot of Evel Knievel's story is him realizing that, oh, well, if I say it, like they'll print it. And you talk about the legend and the folk hero nature of Evel Knievel, and it's like, well, he used that to his advantage, right? And the things that people would press about it. And so when we live in this world where you're absolutely right, Apollonia, like that's how it goes. And so I could literally write anything into a press release. Rylan Grant, who is the former UN ambassador to blah blah blah, and then suddenly it's in a major publication. And you know, Comics Beat reported today that Rylan Grant was the UN ambassador to Morocco. And it's
nobody, it's like, nobody fact checks. And, you know, I probably talked about this before, but, you know, that's actually the secret ingredient of the Ninja Turtles success, is that Peter had training in PR and he wrote a ridiculous press release the weekend the comic came out. And said, the Ninja Turtles are here, the most exciting new comic that's going to dominate the world and blah, 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 blah. And as a, like, they submitted it and the AP ran it.
Yeah.
Like uncritically. I think I've heard Kevin say that, like, if Ronald Reagan had sneezed that weekend, we would have been knocked off. But like, slow weekend.
Slow news day.
And a couple of newspapers ran the Ninja Turtles are here, ! And people fucking took their kids to the local comic book shop and said, where are these Ninja Turtles that are going to be the next big thing? And there's something to be said for like how crucial a part of your thing that is. And it's, you know, anyone that considers themselves any kind of valid artist, even an egomaniac like myself, has a hard time like blowing their own horn and saying, this is the greatest thing in the world. You know, like it's, you want someone else to do it, man. You want anyone else to do it.
Yeah. It's so weird. Cause it's like, you do believe that, like, if you care enough to be running a Kickstarter, which is a ton of work, like you really care about your project and you think it's really good. But then when it comes time, then they're like, well, you have to spend a month telling everyone everywhere it's really good. You're like, well, fuck, I don't want to do that. That's really awkward. I don't have that. I don't have that, like that muscle memory and that skill set honed to like to do that kind of thing. Like I just want to do the work and have someone else champion it.
But yeah, that's the, like, I always remind myself Harrison Ford has to do this. Harrison Ford has to sit in front of 1,000 journalists and pretend that Hollywood Homicide is a good movie for 2 months. You can tell he hates it. He likes it better when the movie's good. I could actually tell that Han Solo had died in a Force Awakens because he was so cheerful during the press.
the end was in sight. Yeah,
he seems really happy about this. And I realize, it's because this is the end of Star Wars for him. And he's thrilled out of his mind. He doesn't have to talk about these movies anymore. But yeah, it's to put your own human face out there and go, this thing that I've made is awesome and you're going to love it. It is not the natural, it's not anyone's natural form, really.
Well, you don't want to come across as phony with it, you know? Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to be hypersensitive kind of overinflating your own stuff, you know? Like, even like, and you want the stuff to sort of sell itself, like, especially with comics. Like, if you have the good pitch and you have the art, like, that is the most effective sales tool a lot of the time, but you do need to complement it by knowing where to, how to get it in front of people and how to give the like sort of performance that's going to make them look at that art and read that that pitch seriously and think it's going to be worth their while.
Performance is such a good word for it because that's what it is. You have to be able to, you know, you have to be able to sell, and comic professionals are not the best salesmen, the best performers all the time. It's why, you know, folks like our friend Chris Longo, you know, who runs Modern Fanatic.
I know Chris.
It's why they make a good living because they are very good at doing that for you, at being a hype man. You know, it's like, hey, you guys need to look at this. This is really good. You know, they already have a relationship. We do a lot of these books. This is one of the best ones. You really should, you know. Go ahead.
I had a meeting Monday morning with a young woman who I was mentoring a tiny bit, and, you know, a shy person. And I was saying, it isn't really a new thing that the product is you. The product has always been you, and the smartest people in every industry, there's a reason you know what Alfred Hitchcock looks like and you know what Stephen King looks like. Hell, you may know what Jackson Pollock looks like. You sure know what Pablo Picasso looks like if you're over a certain age. Like
Quentin Tarantino.
Like, put yourself in the movie. But like, Spike Lee is probably in She's Gotta Have It for a million reasons. But one of the best reasons is you love the little guy. He's hilarious. He's great. He's funny. And now I want to see his next movie. Oh, and he also made this movie. That is fucking awesome. Like, at a certain point, I realized that every single person whose power over their own work I found enviable made themselves the story one way or another. And I will confess, like in an early issue of one of the first two issues of Elvira, the comic, I decided, well, you know, she breaks the fourth wall. I think she should have an ongoing conversation with the comic book writer whose name is David Avalone, and give him a hard time for what's in these comics. And yeah, my name's on the cover. My name's on the inside front cover. That is very different from the movie star. You're reading the comic itself. And Elvira says, hey, Avalone, I don't do exposition, man. I put it on the inside front cover. I'm not interested. There's a thing that I have noticed, which is fame by association. And when someone sees a semi-famous or very famous person regard you in a chummy, collegial light, you are de facto famous. Whatever fame I have is absolutely a side effect of that particular phenomenon. People have seen me in the company of other famous people and go, well, surely he's famous because Jerry Ryan replied to him on Twitter. Ergo, they are the best friends in the world. We're not. I just know her. She's very nice. But it's like people see that as a club. And if they think you're in that club, you might as well be George Clooney.
There's even more power in it because you are the approachable member of the club. Like I'm in the martial
arts. Yeah, relatable.
I am in the martial arts world a lot. And I have studied with a lot of very famous people. And so when I am, you know, Bill Wallace, greatest competitive fighter ever, and is revered by everybody. And if he's at a martial arts tournament, he's the most famous, recognizable, wonderful person there. I've studied with Bill. When Bill comes to the Long Beach tournament, I am there to assist him. I am literally there to hold his bag. I am there to get kicked when he wants to demonstrate kicks for people. I am a fucking tackling dummy and a caddy, but I'm there with Bill. And then, you know, and then Cynthia Rothrock walks up, and I don't really know Cynthia Rothrock, but we kind of know each other because she's great friends with Bill and I'm around Bill a lot. And so then, you know, and then there are all these people standing around and they see me with Bill Wallace and Cynthia Rothrock and Jeff Speakman, and they're not going to go up to any of those people, but if I get alone and I'm messing with Bill's bag, they'll come up to him and be like, yo, do you, you study with Bill? What's up with that? Tell me, you know what I'm saying? It's like, there's more of a power where I could be like, yeah, if you give me $100 right now, I could, I'll introduce you to Bill. You know what I'm saying? There's the way people react to that stuff is so weird.
Yeah, no. And there are also, you know, that $100 bit you just did is like, there are a lot of those characters in the world. There are a lot of hangers
on. Yeah, there are.
And, you know, like, and I promise, you know, people who take advantage of their connection to fame. I remember a million years ago, a cousin of mine was a first AD on Miami Vice, the original television show Miami Vice. And Don Johnson's stunt double came out before he did. And he was, you know, girl would come up to him flirting, and he looked a lot like Don, and you could kind of clock them going, is this him? And he's just not as handsome as he's on television. Like, and he wasn't disabusing anyone of the notion that he was
of course
Don Johnson.
He wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah, like, cause it were, and I've seen roadies do that at rock, like that whole thing of like, oh, hey man, I'll give you access. And there's a lot of parasites out there.
Lots.
And you also, you owe it to your famous and semi-famous friends to not be that person and to be the opposite of that person. I've done a couple of panels with Eastman where the con was supposed to have some kind of security or a door for him to go out or whatever. And we end up going out the main door. And because he's the nicest guy in the world, people jam everything into his hands and say, sign this for me, sign this for me, sign this for me. And I have to be the bad guy and say, Kevin, we're walking. We're walking. He has a signing tomorrow at 2:00. Get online like everybody else.
Or this he'll be there for hours, right?
Like, yeah, this isn't cool, guys. This isn't cool.
A couple years ago, Kevin did this is kind of tangential, but Kevin did this panel at San Diego where he was in conversation about the old days with Simon Bisley. Did you go to that panel?
I was not on that Simon Bisley panel. I'm sorry I missed it. Considering I write Simon as a fictionalized character in Drawing Blood.
Yeah.
I did skip that. But yes, they had quite the storied relationship.
That was one of my favorite panels I've ever seen at San Diego. They had like all these old photographs from when they were living together. Like, it looked like quite a time, but like, that was
we were there for the uncle panel, Kevin's uncle, the one he borrowed the $1,200
a couple of years ago. I think on the 40th anniversary of the Turtles, Kevin had his uncle Quentin, who lent them the $1,200 to print the 3,000. We always call him 80s Kickstarter.
Original Kickstarter.
Uncle, you know. But that's the thing. It's like, that's the opposite. You know, Uncle Quentin is the opposite of being a Nepo baby. Kevin is not any kind of Nepo baby. But when it comes on down to it, you couldn't make your indie comic in the 80s without somebody to give you $1,200 to print 3,000 of the damn things.
You need like, those people. Yeah.
Without Uncle Quentin, Kevin Eastman is very possibly, you know, a middle-aged lobster shucker in Maine. And I mean no disrespect to Kevin.
Is that a euphemism? I don't understand.
No, that was what he was doing when the Ninja Turtles was coming out. Was working in seafood stores and at the docks and stuff like that.
At this point, he'd probably be managing the other shuckers.
We'd hope.
head shucker.
Senior shucker. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, 11 years ago, I was a videographer. And there's nothing wrong with being a videographer, but I hated it. it's not what I wanted to do. I wasn't writing anything. I wasn't creating anything that I was proud of.
I was doing English subtitles for DVD releases. So to this day, if you put on the old DVDs of Night Court or Seinfeld or MacGyver, you will see the English subtitles that I created and edited. And then all of the other subtitles were just basically like plunked into my editing. So that was my, that was my years ago job.
Man, that seems attention to detail very important for that one. That would be a rough one.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yep. The last time I did that, it was because I had produced the movie and I couldn't afford to have a guy do it. It was easier for me to just do it. And that movie, I think, is on Amazon right now. So that's nice. But I wanted to, before we wrap up, I wanted to dive into the origin of this, of your current Kickstarter project. Clearly, it is based on life experience. And you're doing something that I particularly love doing, which is what I call autobiographical science fiction. When you take memoir material and you go, I'm going to put a werewolf in it. You know, like
that's exactly what I did. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm gonna write about this time in my life, and I'm just gonna add a supernatural element to make it a genre story that people will read. But I'm writing about my time as a reporter in South Texas. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I think what happens is like that time, like it starts to become fictional to an extent in your head anyway. I was a reporter down there, like 2009, like so by this time in my life it's taken on its own mystique and kind of its own mythology. Mm-hmm. and I was working at a newspaper during the recession, so horror was not a tough jump to make genre wise from like what it felt to be like in McAllen, Texas in the middle of the recession working for a newspaper. Right. And then conveniently also, like, I started out on the night cops beat for the first few years, but then I had also moved to feature writing, and we did a lot of, like, you know, every October you do the like local haunted house stories and local legend stories. So conveniently I had a lot of that sort of like in the back of my mind as well. So I was able to mash it up with like the things I was feeling at that time, which were pretty desperate and afraid, like, which makes for good horror, with the actual like local legends of the area. So it just felt like a pretty easy jump to make to emphasize like, what would have been in a memoir anyway, like it to kind of like right. pump it up to the like level that to like make it more powerful.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you know, that's the horriest piece of writing advice is always write what you know. But yeah. I even take a step back from that and say, try to have a life worth writing about. You know, try to yeah. do things aside from the things you do sitting at the machine with your hands on the keyboard. Try to do things, try to feel big feelings, try to go places and meet people.
Well, and the great thing too is like, so like, you know, spending your early 20s in McAllen, Texas is maybe not the best thing for a young person to do, you know, but if you can make it work for you as a writer, it doesn't seem so bad years later, you know. It was an adventure.
It can be a writer cliche, but I have definitely walked into experiences and said, in 3 months, this is just going to be one other crazy fucking thing that I did. And it just goes on the list of crazy fucking things that I've done in my life. And that's not a bad list to have, actually, the list of crazy fucking things you've done in your life.
No, it's not.
The crazy things can serve us, but it's also, I mean, it's like sometimes we've been through something, you know, like it also sounds like there's a little trauma in this. Maybe that's too tough a word, but it's like, I mean, here's the thing is like, I did the same thing. The Jump is about a young man who has grown up in a housing project in Detroit and had something very violent happen to him. He's not dealing with it. He is escaping into another world to deal with it. He's running from it. And so now I'm not a regular astral projector. I have never fought a centuries old war on the astral plane. Everything else is right out of my fucking, my life, my history, right down to the place. And I ran from my stuff forever and it ate away.
Yeah.
At me.
Yeah.
And the only thing that's ever worked, and you know, you do your therapy, you do your group things and talking about it helps. The only thing that's ever really worked, the silver bullet for me, was always turning directly towards it and dealing with it. It was writing about what I have gone through, writing about my
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
Putting it into a format that someone else could read and draw a lesson from, digest all of that stuff. That is what's worked for me. And I get the sense that there is at the very least a little bit of that in here. Like,
oh yeah. I mean,
terms with this. Yeah.
Doing this comic was tremendously cathartic. Like, and I, in a way I didn't expect, like when I started doing it, I just thought Werewolf Priest was a cool idea. And then like, and then I approached it, tried to make it more relatable by incorporating something I had been through. And by, I don't know if you had this experience with The Jump, but when the art comes back, that's when you really feel the catharsis that like someone else has helped bring these things you've been through and you have to say to life. Like that's when I think it really, the full force of it hits you, that you've been able to like kind of process these things you've been running from and turn them into an actual story is an incredibly powerful experience. And it's like, even if the comic doesn't do well, I recommend making a comic about the things you can't let go of.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like it's worth it in itself to make it exist.
Here's the thing. Every Tuesday, Ben Franzen and I from the Ben Free Project, we walk into a prison, the California State Penitentiary at Lancaster. We walk in, we sit down with 25 guys who are incarcerated, some for their entire lives. And these are guys who have been through something. And we teach them, we help them make comic books about what they have been through.
Amazing.
We help them deal with their stuff by putting stuff on the page. And it is fucking life changing, you know. It's not for everybody, but the guys that really lean into it. And we're not going in there and preaching, and we're not going in there and trying to fix anybody, and we're not doing anything of that. It is just simply like, you know, we walk in and it's like, here is what has worked for me. Here is how and why it has worked. We're going to show you how to do it. Try it out. And if it works for you, like, lean the fuck into it. And the number of like hard dudes that come in and being like, I'm not making fucking comic books, blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to sit here and blah, blah, blah. And then just over time, they get drawn in and drawn in and drawn in. And then in the end, they are making earth shattering fucking shit and like untying knots right and left and all this stuff. It's wonderful.
Well, and the other thing is making comics is fun. Like, it, like, what, whatever trauma you're dealing with, it, and there's serious comics. There's very difficult comics that I'm sure were painful for people to make, but comics begs you to incorporate fun into it, right? Like I'm dealing with the sort of like idealism in your early 20s smashing up against the realities of a difficult job market with a werewolf priest. That's fun. Like, that's like, yeah, you're kind of confronting these things that have hung with you and have been difficult with comics, which lets you be ridiculous. And one of the best ways to process the hard things you've been through can be with humor, you know? So I think it's a unique medium. And I bet, I don't know, I'd imagine a lot of the guys you work with have fun with what they're doing as well, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You, and I always make the point about genre and allegory that even if you don't encounter werewolves, even if you don't encounter demons and aliens and whatever, the world feels vivid to the people who live in it. And when you're struggling with your demons, quote unquote, to some people, a scene where someone is actually fighting demons feels more like what they went through than a scene where a guy's sitting in an office with a therapist. You know what I mean? Even if that's where they fought with their demons in the real world, it felt bigger than that. They sweated, they cried, they had big experiences sitting on that couch or whatever made them struggle with their demons. I always defend genre as this is how the world feels to people. This is why we write this shit. But because it feels bigger than reality allows you to portray, you know, and that's ultimately the Kickstarter I've got going on right now. The short story that I have in it is about my crush on my next door neighbor when I was a little boy and our friendship. And I believed that she was in an abusive family relationship. In the short story, I made her father a mad scientist with a dimension cracking machine. That's not what he was like. But
no, yeah, of course
it felt that big when I was a kid. And it gave me an excuse to write about that real life relationship that meant a lot to me. And that's, you know, I always feel like that's kind of the holy grail when you can address something that means something to you and also package it in the most entertaining way possible. One of my jokes, you know, actually my last paper in film school had the premise, the intentionally absurd premise, that Fellini's 8½ and King Kong are the same movie. They're both about a man trying to get a film made. Over the course of the film, he describes the film that he would like to end up with. Before the end of the film, he abandons his plan to make that film, and the film you're watching is the film he described. Carl Denham at the beginning of King Kong says he wants to make some Beauty and the Beast thing.
Yeah.
Well, here we are watching it, Carl. Even though he put down his movie camera and picked up a rifle 20 minutes into the movie, somehow we have ended up with Carl Denham's perfect Beauty and the Beast movie. Just as Fellini has ended up with his perfect midlife crisis movie after he abandons making his midlife crisis movie in the last minutes of 8 and a half. So to me, that's the best magic trick, is, you know, having the cake and eating it too, making the thing that you want to make and still reflecting yourself and still reflecting real things and real feelings in your life. I really think some of the best art goes that way. And sometimes you don't know until it's over. Sometimes you finish writing a thing and you go, ah, that's what I'm working out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It comes clear to you as you kind of get deeper into it and you find just kind of some honesty that was kind of hidden under, like, why was I obsessed with this idea of the werewolf priest? And then it's like you get more and more into doing that and you find what's under it eventually.
It is, yeah. The beauty of doing a series is, like, you know, I mean, if you're doing a series for a traditional publisher, you got to write this document out. You got to tell them every twist and turn of it. And you got to tell them what it's about, but you don't know what it's about until you're.
No, I don't understand how you could do that. Like, outline a full series before you gotten into the nitty gritty of the story beats of the first issue. Like,
and it's,
I know
it's
people do it all the time, but it seems difficult.
And I love, you know, again, like when I do Aberrant, I got to churn out 10 issues, like boom, 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 boom. And it is a snapshot of that time of my life, that time in history, all that. But something like The Jump is interesting, where I'm kind of doing it piece by piece over the course of years. And so I'm doing The Jump 4, and we have this kind of election craziness happening. We have the fires in Altadena. And that is what I'm dealing with. You know, there's a lot of internal stuff also, but it's like, well, I'm dealing with these things. Like, I know I kind of want to tell a certain kind of story, but all that stuff is going to marry, right? This nice stew. It's all going to marinate and come together. And you can really look back. I mean, it's interesting to go and, you know, Suicide Jockeys has, Suicide Jockeys is dealing with this battle between Trump and Bernie Sanders, back in the day. And the things I'm dealing with back then and how it all ended up and the shots I called. The whole idea of this, it's a kaiju book, but the idea is, well, everything that was happening in the world, in our world, was happening in this book. The one buy-in is that also monsters are coming out of the water and attacking cities.
Yeah, sure.
To a degree, that was the monsters. It was like the fifth craziest thing that was happening in the world at that time. And that was the whole gist of the book. And I just think that's so interesting looking back. And it's like, cause a friend of mine, was looking back at Suicide Jockeys, and I wrote it, you know, years ago. But she was like, man, the stuff you called in here, it's a little bit scary. It was difficult to revisit that time. And it is difficult how kind of prescient the book is. I love these things as time capsules, right? Time capsules of thought and fear and hope and all this stuff.
Yeah, well, you put stuff in there that you think this is outrageous. Like, I'm gonna go bigger and make this more outrageous than it could possibly be. And then reality kind of checks you. Things can become like this.
Yeah.
I wrote a book in 2015 about, that took place in 39. No. Yeah. 39. And it had American Nazis in it. And I used the real ones. I used their actual camp in Long Island, Camp Siegfried. I had the uniforms recreated by artist Dave Acosta. And when it was reviewed, people all referred to the fictional Camp Siegfried. They didn't believe it. Reviewers could not believe that I had not made up the American Nazi movement in 1939. Wow. They were all under a certain age, you know, and it really presented me with a problem that I haven't solved yet, which is that when you're doing historical fiction, how do you signal, no, this, the guy who can read minds and make himself invisible, he's not real. But these American Nazis are absolutely 100% real, and they really happened, and they're not a sci-fi villain. They're a thing. And when it came out and then Trump won the election, a lot of people were like, oh, you're writing about Trump. I'm like, no, I really wasn't. I was writing about 1939. It's just these things come around all the time.
Yeah.
Look back at Banjax, written in 2019, and see what I had to say about a government using the military against the people, about the government, you know, being in the pocket of a tech billionaire, of all these things, you know. I look at Aberrant a couple of years before, you know, and what it had to say about some stuff like that. It's interesting. It's like, it's in the air, you know. It's not like I called.
Yeah.
This shit.
Yeah.
It's just like, it was already in motion.
Percolating.
And, yeah. If I was,
all I did was stop and look at it, and I'm like, where is this all headed? Let me imagine the worst thing. And it's like you said, Zach, it's like, well, sometimes I nailed the worst thing. Sometimes we blew so far past that, that it almost feels like I undercut it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, if I were Denis Villeneuve trying to come up with a Bond movie for 2026, I'd adapt Moonraker, in which a tech billionaire takes over the space program because he's secretly a Nazi who wants to destroy the world. I don't know, man. I think that's a very 2026.
It is. It really is. And that line used to seem like the most ridiculous Bond possible.
And yeah. Ian Fleming really kind of. The thing that kills me about Ian Fleming, as an aside, is that he was from the upper crust, but he very much hated them. And every James Bond villain is some guy he thought was basically, he'd meet Donald Trump at the club and go, that guy's the fucking worst. And he cheats at golf and he treats his wife like shit and he's a scumbag. I'm going to. Villain in the next Trump finger. That's what we're doing next time. You know, like every Bond villain is some dude he actually knew who he thought was a douchebag. And it's all rich douchebags. It's all, you know, captains of industry and, you know, bankers and industrialists and all that. And, you know, some of it is tinged with some classic British bigotry. But he was not wrong about rich folk.
No, that worked out well for him.
Yeah. And even, you know, I was reminded that, you know, when, you know, Trump had the cancer charity that he was stealing money from, I was reminded that Spectre's cover organization is that it's an international refugee resettlement program. That's what Spectre actually hides behind. Yeah. In Thunderball, there are, Spectre hides behind being a global charity because it allows you to be all over the world and have offices.
Do we need to drop it allegedly in that cancer? Legal's whispering.
No. That was adjudicated in New York. He and his children can no longer run a charity in New York because of that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's not an allegedly. Yeah. That's a. There was a verdict, and he paid a fine, and you know. Yeah. And, you know, it made you laugh because it's outlandish, stealing from cancer, children with cancer. But he did it. It's a real thing.
And you would think it would upset people, and it doesn't. Like, so many people are able to just totally either deny that it happened or look right past it. So,
It's all, you know. It's,
but Hillary's emails, though. I mean, come on.
It always boils down to identity. I call it Confederate soldier syndrome, where you're literally willing to die so that the richest guy in your hometown cannot have to hire you for a job.
Yeah.
But you're doing it because that guy symbolizes a society in which at least you're better than black people.
Right. Yeah.
You're still poor. You still don't have a job. You're still living on scraps, but at least there's someone lower than you. And that's what that guy started a war over. So you're going to die for him. It's the saddest, craziest thing in the world.
It explains a lot, though.
Common as hell.
Yeah.
It's common as hell. And luckily, those movements are often defeated in combat by people who would rather be doing anything else. Someone posted that the other day when Hegseth started talking about warrior cults. someone posted, I can't remember where, that like World War II is the story of an elite warrior cult that got wiped out by a bunch of guys that just rather would have been doing any other fucking thing with their life. You know, bunch of ribbon clerks from America, a bunch of cashiers. Given rifles and sent to Europe and this is what a drag, man. Like, I got to save the world for fucking democracy from these assholes, you know? And meanwhile, those assholes are like, we are the best. We are the elite. We can defeat anyone, you know? And a bunch of grocery store clerks beat the shit out of them. You know, God bless America. And on that patriotic note,
hoorah.
One more. Zach, one more time, give us the name of the Kickstarter, where people can find it. Obviously, we will put the link on the on the page when we do this show.
Kickstarter is Macabre Valley, number one, running through October 15th, Wednesday, October 15th. So, yeah, if you're hearing this, the PDF will be available as soon as the campaign ends, and we're going to try our hardest to fulfill by Halloween. So we'll see how that goes.
Great. But, yeah, and a couple of quick questions. Is this, what is the size of this? Is it a first issue? Is it a graphic novel?
Yeah.
What
is it? It's a 30-page first issue.
Okay.
32 pages with a little bit of back matter, but 30 pages of story. Yeah.
And who's the artist again?
Hopefully the first of four. Anna Redman, she's out of the UK, very talented future star artist. She's done some stuff for 2000 AD. But she's incredible. The colorist is Brad Simpson, and the letterer is Becca Carey, with design by Jared Fletcher, who did the design for Paper Girls. So pretty excited to see how that comes out.
2000 AD is, for me, the comics version. When there's an actor that lives in New York, if they haven't been on Law & Order, you have to be a little suspicious. If there's an Australian actor and they've never been on Neighbors, you're like, how have you not been on Neighbors? If it's a British actor, it's EastEnders. Like, there are 7,000 episodes of EastEnders, surely. And for me, 2000 AD is the comics version of that in Europe, but particularly England. Everyone good,
definitely in the UK,
has done a couple of, you know, pages at least on 2000 AD. But I know, like, Italian artists and French artists and Spanish artists who've done it as well. And it's a great testing ground.
It really is. Yeah.
Everybody does sort of go through there at one point or another, which is awesome. And where can people find you on the social medias?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram as Comics Bookcase, and I'm on Blue Sky as Zach Quaintance. And then if you really want to keep up with my work, you can go to comicsbookcase.com. Sign up for the newsletter, and that is the most surefire way to make sure you don't miss any of my criticism or comics that I'm writing. So please do that.
Yeah. Excellent. And Rylan, where can the kids at home find you?
I am at Rylan Grant on all forms of social media. That is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. If you're just listening, most of you are. I have to spell it for you because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to
spell
it.
I always wondered about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's your first name.
It's actually I believe it is originally an Irish surname, but the Irish surname is usually spelled R-Y-L-A-N-D. I am Scottish. Don't ask me why I have an Irish name. It was actually it was the name of a close friend of my dad's who died right before I was born, and so my mom didn't have a she didn't have a say in it. She woke up after a very tough birth and a surgery after, and that name was on the side of the incubator or whatever. And
well, you'll have easy to find on Google, though. So
exactly.
There you go. My book, my latest and greatest, Evel Knievel, The Last Gladiator, a collaboration with the Evel Knievel family, the Evel Knievel brand, the Evel Knievel Museum. It is live on Kickstarter right now. Issue one is, and we're kind of kicking ass and taking names. It's a really good book drawn by Dave Acosta with covers by Ray Anthony Height and Flops and John Pinto and Fabio Alves. Go check it out. We got plenty of amazing Evel Knievel swag over there. We got pins and skateboards, and sort of very lovingly, painstakingly, restored and remastered old event posters that were thought lost to history. Really unique and amazing campaign, particularly if you are an Evel Knievel fan, so go check it out.
Super cool, yeah.
Very nice. And speaking of easy to Google, David Avalone is an incredibly easy name to Google. And you can find me on all the social medias under my real name. I'm pushing the Patreon pretty hard right now. I started that in June, and that's got a lot of content on it. Weekly newsletter is free. For a little money, you get some of my some PDFs of some stuff I've written, some comics, and a little more exclusive video and essay content as well. So find me on there. But otherwise, you can find me on Blue Sky. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. And November 8th, I'll be at the Revenge of Comic Creator Block Party again, which is a great comics event. And if you're in the area, you should stop by. But thanks, everyone. Thank you, Zach, for joining us. It's great talking to you.
Yeah, and thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And we will catch you all on the next exciting episode of The Writer's Block.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.